Underworld. Disc 27.
Most of our longings go unfulfilled. This is the word's wistful implication, a desire for something lost or fled or otherwise out of reach. In Phoenix now, with the years blowing by, I take a drive sometimes out past the regimented typeface on the map and down through the streets named for Indian tribes and past the roofing supply and sandblasting and the condom outlet, painted now in ice cream flavors. And finally I see the impressive open steel truss of the waste facility down off Lower Buckeye Road, with grackles sparking across the landfill and the planes in a long line coming out of the hazy mountains to drop into approach patterns. Marion and I are closer now, more intimate than we've ever been. The serrate edges have dulled away. We go to Tucson to see our daughter and granddaughter. We redecorate our house, building new bookshelves all the time, buying new carpets to set on top of the old ones. And we walk along the drainage canal in the twilight and tell each other stories of the past. In the bronze tower, I stand by the window and look at the hills and ridges, and it's 110 degrees out on the street, and I always wear a suit, even if I'm only here to check the mail. And I listen to the microtonal hum of the systems and feel a quiet kind of power because I've done it and come out okay, done it and won, gone in weak and come out strong. And I do my imitation gangster for the elevator guy. We separate our household waste according to the guidelines. We rinse out the used cans and empty bottles and put them in their respective bins. We do tin versus aluminum. We use a paper bag for the paper bags, pressing the smaller bags flat and fitting them into the large bag that we've set aside for the purpose. We bundle the newspapers, but do not tie them in twine. The long ghosts are walking the halls. When my mother died, I felt expanded, slowly, durably, over time. I felt suffused with her truth, spread through as with water, color, or light. I thought she'd entered the deepest place I could provide, the animating entity, the thing, if anything, that will survive my own last breath. And she makes me larger. She amplifies my sense of what it is to be human. She is part of me now, total and consoling. And it is not a sadness to acknowledge that she had to die before I could know her fully. It is only a statement of the power of what comes after. They are trading garbage in the commodity pits in Chicago. They are making synthetic feces in Dallas. You can sell your testicles to a firm in Russia that will give you $4,000, and then remove the items surgically and mash them up and extract the vital substances and market the resulting syrupy stuff as rejuvenating beauty cream for a profit that is awesome. We take the TV set out of the cool room at the back of the house. Lainey's old room, our daughter, which is my mother's old room now. The room with the humidifier and the resilvered mirror and the good, hard, healthy bed. And we build bookshelves there. At Waste Containment, I become a sort of executive emeritus. I go to the office now and then, but mostly travel and speak. I visit colleges and research facilities where I'm introduced as a waste analyst. I talk to them about the vacated military bases being converted to landfill use, about the bunker system under a mountain in Nevada that will or will not accommodate thousands of steel canisters of radioactive waste for 10,000 years. Then we eat lunch. The waste may or may not explode, 70,000 tons of spent fuel. And I fly to London and Zurich to attend conferences in the rain and sleet. I rearrange books on the old shelves and match and mix for the new shelves, and then I stand there looking. I stand in the living room and look. Or I walk through the house and look at the things we own and feel the odd mortality that clings to every object. The finer and rarer the object, the more lonely it makes me feel. And I don't know how to account for this. Marion, mid-50s, is lean and tanned, and not so edgy now, it's clear, and a little more measured in her approach to the moment. The moment suddenly no longer matters. We take drives in the desert, and sometimes I tell her things she didn't know, or knew at an unlearned level, the way you know you're sleepy or sad. When I come across his name on a document, it always makes me pause. It gives me pause, the name in jumpy type on some stamped document. James Nicholas Costanza. The raised stamp that marks a thing official. The document in the dusty bottom drawer. The sense of slight confusion until I realize who he is. I drive out there sometimes and see grackles sparking across the landfill, down past the Indian tribe streets, and sometimes I take our granddaughter along when she is here on a visit, and we see the sage-gray truss of the waste facility, and the planes and their landing patterns, and the showy desert plants spilling over the pastel walls above the parking area. I fly to Zurich and Lisbon to exchange ideas and make proposals. And it is the kind of desperate crisis, the intractability of waste, that doesn't really seem to be taking place except in the conference reports and the newspapers. It is not otherwise touchable somehow, for all the menacing heft and breadth of the material, the actual pulsing thing. Everybody is everywhere at once. Jeff likes to say this, our son, who still lives at home, and still says things with the smirky sort of shyness he has brought with him out of adolescence, a quality that turns nearly everything he says into a lubricious hint about some secret he is keeping. They are making synthetic feces in Dallas. They have perfected a form of simulated human waste in order to test diapers and other protective garments. The compound comes in a dry mix made of starches, fibers, resins, gelatins, and polyvinyls. You add water for desired consistency. The color is usually brown. Nostra etate, as the popes like to say. In our time. He went out to get a pack of cigarettes and never came back. He smoked Lucky Strikes. He smoked the brand where they said, "Light up a Lucky, it's light up time." Be happy, go lucky. That was another thing they said. Jeff has jobs on and off, waits on tables in a food court somewhere, and spends tremendous amounts of time with his computer. He visits a website devoted to miracles. There are many reports, he tells us, of people flocking to uranium mines in order to cure themselves. They come from Europe, Canada, and Australia, on crutches and in wheelchairs, and they sit in tunnels under rangeland in Montana, where the radon emissions are many hundreds of times higher than the federal safety level. They're trying to cure themselves of arthritis, diabetes, blindness, and cancer. There are reports that crippled dogs have risen and walked. Jeff tells us this and smirks shyly, either because he thinks it's funny, or because he thinks it's funny and believes it. We have bookshelves built in the cool room at the back of the house, my mother's old room. And you know how time slips by when you're doing books, arranging and rearranging, the way time goes by untouched, matching and mixing inventively, and then you stand in the room and look. I tell you what I long for. The days of disarray, when I didn't give a damn or a fuck or a farthing. Matt came out for the funeral. He flew out the night before with two of his kids, and then broke down at the gravesite. And they saw this and were astonished. They were shocked to see this because they thought of him as a father, not a son. And they looked away and then sneaked a glance, and then looked away again when he fell against me and wept. And they saw me put an arm around him and had to adjust to this. The shock of seeing him as a brother and a son. I still respond to that thing you feel in an office. Wearing a crisp suit and sensing the linked grids lap around you. It is all about the enfolding drone of the computers and fax machines. It is about the cell phones slotted in the desk chargers, the voicemail and email, a sense of order and command, reinforced by the office itself, and the bronze tower that encases the office, and by all the contact points that shimmer in the air somewhere. We remove the wax paper from cereal boxes before we put the boxes out for collection. The streets are dark and empty. We do clear glass versus colored glass, and it's remarkable, really, how quiet it is. A stillness that feels old and settled, with landmark status. The yard waste, the paper bags pressed flat. The hour after sunset when a pause obtains in the world, and you forget for a second where you are. They sit on wooden benches in the mines and breathe radon air, and soak their feet in deadly radon water. And they pray and chant, and sing soaring hymns, or maybe just ordinary songs, dinky sing-alongs. The kind of songs that people have always sung, doing things in groups. When we go for long drives, we go for long drives out past the retirement compounds and onto the long straight interstate where kestrels sit spaced on the power lines. And sometimes I apply suntan lotion to my arms and face, and there's a smell of beach, a sense of heat and beach, the haze of slick stuff across the hair on my forearm, and the way the tube pops and sucks when it goes empty. I get reminded of something way back when. No one talks about the Texas Highway Killer anymore. You never hear the name. The name used to be in the air, always on the verge of being spoken, of re-entering the broadcast band and causing a brief excitation along the lined highways. But the shootings have evidently ended, and the name is gone now. But sometimes I think of him and wonder if he is still out there, driving and looking, not done with this thing at all, but only waiting. When I tell her things, she listens with a high, clear alertness, so vigilant and still. And she seems to know what I'm going to say before I say it. I tell her about the time I spent in correction and why they put me there, and she seems to know it at some level already. She looks at me as if I were 17. She sees me at 17. We take long walks along the drainage canal. All the hints and intimations, all the things she spied in me at the beginning of our time together, come to some completion now. If not for me, then for her. Because I don't know what happened, do I? We bundle the newspapers but do not tie them in twine, which is always the temptation. He enters 17 characters and then .com miraculum. And the miracles come scrolling down. At dinner one night, he tells us about a miracle in the Bronx. Jeff is shy about the Bronx, shy and guilty. He thinks it is part of the American gulag, a place so distant from his experience that those who've emerged can't possibly be willing to spend a moment in a room with someone like him. But here we are at the table, sharing a meal, and he tells about a miracle that took place earlier in the decade and is still a matter of some debate, at least, on the web, the net. A young girl was the victim of a terrible crime, body found in a vacant lot amid dense debris, identified and buried. The girl memorialized on a graffiti wall nearby. And then the miracle of the images, and the subsequent crush of people, and the belief and disbelief. Mostly belief, it seems. We ask him questions, but he is tentative with this kind of material. He is shy. He feels he doesn't have the credentials to relate a tale of such intensity. All that suffering and faith and openness of emotion transpiring in the Bronx. I tell him what better place for the study of wonders. It is 108 degrees out on the street. 110, 112, and I go to the airport and fly to Lisbon and Madrid, or I stand in the living room and look at the books. Jeff is a lurker. He visits sites but does not post. He gathers the waves and rays. He adds components and functions and sits before a spreading mass of compatible hardware. The real miracle is the web, the net, where everybody is everywhere at once, and he is there among them, unseen. the intimacies we've come to share, the belated exchange of childhoods and other ferocious times, and something else, a firm grip of another kind, a different direction, not back but forward, the grasp of objects that bind us to some betokening. I think I sense Marion missing in the objects on the walls and shelves. There is something somber about the things we've collected and own, the household effects. There is something about the word itself, effects. The lacquered chest in the alcove that breathes a kind of sadness. The wall hangings and artifacts and valuables. And I feel a loneliness, a loss, all the greater and stranger when the object is relatively rare. And it's the hour after sunset in a stillness that feels unceasing. We walk along the drainage canal past tree trunks limed white, white against the sun. The earth opened up, and he stepped inside. I think it felt that way not only to us, but to Jimmy as well. I think he went under. I don't think he wanted a fresh start, or a new life, or even an escape. I think he wanted to go under. He lived day to day and step to step, and did not wonder what would become of us, or how she would manage, or how tall we grew, or how smart we became. I don't think he spent a minute thinking about these things. I think he just went under. The failure it brought down on us does not diminish. This is how I came across the baseball, rearranging books on the shelves. I look at it and squeeze it hard and put it back on the shelf, wedged between a slanted book and a straight-up book, an expensive and beautiful object that I keep half-hidden, maybe because I tend to forget why I bought it. Sometimes I know exactly why I bought it, and other times I don't. A beautiful thing, smudged green near the Spalding trademark, and bronzed with nearly half a century of earth and sweat and chemical change. And I put it back and forget it until next time. They said LSMFT, Lucky Strike, means fine tobacco. Lucky Strike, in quotes they said, it's toasted. The planes come sparking out of the mountains to the south, glinting in the haze as they approach in a long line to make their landings. And I see the open steel truss of the waste facility at the end of the road. I park beneath terraced gardens that send bougainvillea spilling over the pastel walls. My granddaughter is with me, Sunny. She is nearly six now. And inside the vast recycling shed, we stand on a catwalk and watch the operations in progress. The tin, the paper, the plastics, the styrofoam. It all flies down the conveyor belts, 400 tons a day, assembly lines of garbage, sorted, compressed, and baled, transformed in the end to square-edged units, products again, wire-bound and smartly stacked and ready to be marketed. Sonny loves this place, and so do the other kids who come with their parents or teachers to stand on the catwalk and visit the exhibits. Brightness streams from skylights down to the floor of the shed, falling on the tall machines with a numinous glow. Maybe we feel a reverence for waste, for the redemptive qualities of the things we use and discard. Look how they come back to us, alight with a kind of brave aging. The windows yield a strong, broad desert and enormous sky. The landfill across the road is closed now, jammed to capacity. But gas keeps rising from the great earthen berm, methane, and it produces a wavering across the land and sky that deepens the aura of sacred work. It is like a fable in the writhing air of some ghost civilization, a shimmer of desert ruin. The kids love the machines, the balers and hoppers and long conveyors, and the parents look out the windows through the methane mist, and the planes come out of the mountains and align for their approach, and the trucks are arrayed in two columns outside the shed, bringing in the unsorted slop, the gut squalor of our lives, and taking the baled and bound units out into the world again. The chunky product blocks, pristine, newsprint for newsprint, tin for tin. And we all feel better when we leave. I drink aged grappa and listen to jazz. I do the books on the new shelves and stand in the living room and look at the carpets and wall hangings, and I know the ghosts are walking the halls. But not these halls, and not this house. They're all back there in those railroad rooms, at the narrow end of the night. And I stand helpless in this desert place, looking at the books. I long for the days of disorder. I want them back. The days when I was alive on the earth, rippling in the quick of my skin, heedless and real. I was dumb-muscled and angry and real. This is what I long for. The breach of peace, the days of disarray, when I walked real streets and did things slap-bang and felt angry and ready all the time, a danger to others and a distant mystery to myself. http://blk.www.dd.com/miraculum. Her name is Esmeralda. She lives wild in the inner ghetto, a slice of the South Bronx called the Wall. A girl who forages in empty lots for discarded clothes, plucks spoiled fruit from garbage bags behind bodegas, who is sometimes seen running through the trees and weeds, a shadow on the rubbled walls of demolished structures, unstumbling, a tactful runner with the sweet and easy stride of some creature of sylvan myth. The nuns have been trying to find her. Sister Grace, the younger of the two, determined to track and catch the girl and get her to a relief agency, or to their convent in the middle Bronx, somewhere safe, examine her, feed her properly, get her enrolled in school. Sister Edgar, seeing a radiant grace in the girl, a reprieve from the Wall's endless distress, even a source of personal hope, a goad to the old rugged faith. All heaven trembles when a soul swings in the wind. Save her from danger. Bring her to candles and ashes and palms, to belief in the mystical body. The nuns deliver food to people living in the Wall and nearby, the asthmatic children and sickle cell adults, the cases of AIDS and the cocaine babies. And every day, twice a day, three or four times a day, they drive their van past the memorial wall. This is the six-story flank of a squatter's tenement on which graffiti writers spray-paint an angel every time a local child dies of illness or mistreatment. Gracie talks and drives and yells out the window at dogs doing duty in the street. She wears a skirt and a windbreaker. She carries a can of chemical mace. Old spindle-shanked Edgar sits next to her and feels the aura of the streets, and thinks herself back into another century. She is cinctured and veiled, and would not know how to dress otherwise, and would not be here at all if the children were healthy and the dogs middle class. Gracie says, "Sometimes I wonder." "What do you wonder?"
"Never mind, sister, forget it."
"You wonder if we make a difference. You can't understand how the last decade of the century looks worse than the first in some respects. Looks like another century in another country."
"I'm a positive person," Gracie says.
Edgar has a high-frequency laugh that travels through time and space, a sort of cackle, frankly, shrill and dank. She thinks the dogs can probably hear it. "I know there's a laborious procedure you have to follow," she says, "in order to attain a positive state of mind. It's a wonder you have strength left over to steer the car." This pisses Gracie off, and she rails a bit, respectfully, as the van approaches the salvage operation of Ismael Munoz. A mass of junked cars, a pack jam, cars smash-heaped and jackknifed, 70 or 80 cars, shamefaced. The nuns look instinctively for a sign of Esmeralda, who probably spends her nights sleeping in one of these cars. Then they park the van and enter the derelict tenement, climbing three flights of crumbling stairs to Ismael's headquarters. Edgar expects him to look wan and drawn, visibly fragile. She thinks he has AIDS. It is a thing she senses. She senses dire things. She stands at a distance, studying him. An affable sort of human shambles in a tropical shirt and slapdash beard, he's in a lively mood today, because he has managed to rig a system in the building that produces enough power to run a TV set. "Sisters, look," he says. They see a little kid, Juano, seated on a stationary bike, pedaling frantically. The bike is linked to a World War II generator that Ismael got cheap in an armory liquidation. The generator is throbbing in the basement, and there are cables running from the unit up to the TV set. And there is a wheezing drive belt connecting the TV set to the bicycle. When the kid fast pedals the bike, the generator ekes out a flow of electricity to the television set. A brave, beat-up model that two of the other kids dug out of the garbage pits, where it was layered in the geological age of leisure-time appliances. Gracie is delighted and sits with the graffiti crew, 8 or 9 kids, watching the stock market channel. Ismael says, "What do you think? I did okay. This is just a startup. I got things I'm planning big time." Edgar disapproves, of course. This is her mission, to disapprove. One of the stern mercies of the wall, a place unlinked to the usual services, is that TV has not been available. Now, here it is, suddenly. You touch a button and all the things concealed from you for centuries come flying into the remotest room. It's an epidemic of seeing. No conceivable recess goes unscanned, in the uterus, under the ocean, to the lost halls of the human brain. And if you can see it, you can catch it. There's a pathogenic element in a passing glance. Ismael says, "I'm planning to go online real soon, sisters. Advertise my junk cars. Go, like, global. Scrap metal for these trodden countries looking to build a military." On the screen, an image flicks and jumps. It's a man's discoid head, a fellow in a white shirt with blue collar. Or blue shirt with white collar. There's a fairly frequent color shift. He's talking about the big board composite, while numbers and letters flow in two bands across the bottom of the screen. A blue band and a white band. And the crew sits watching. And the kid on the bike is bent and pedaling, a furious, pumping boy. And the names and prices flow in two different directions, with active issues blinking. Ismael says, "Some people have a personal god, okay? I'm looking to get a personal computer. What's the difference, right?" Ismael likes to tease the nuns. Edgar watches him carefully. She admires the graffiti wall, the angels arrayed row after row, blue for boys, pink for girls. But she is wary of the man who runs the project, and she tries to understand the disappointment she feels seeing Ismael in good spirits and evidently healthy. Does sister want him to be deathly ill? Does she think he ought to be punished for being homosexual? Everybody's watching TV except for her. She's watching Ismael. No pallor or weight loss or lesions or other visible symptoms. The only thing he shows is a snaggle smile from out of his history of dental neglect. Why does she want to see him suffer? Isn't he one of the affirmative forces in the wall, earning money with his salvage business, using it more or less altruistically? Teaching his crew of stray kids, abandoned some of them, pregnant one or two, runaways, throwaways, giving him a sense of responsibility and self-worth? And doesn't he help the nuns feed the hungry? She studies him for marks, for early signs of incapacity. Then she steals a look out the window, hoping to glimpse the elusive girl. Sister has seen her a number of times from this window, almost always running. Run is what she does. It is her beauty and her safety both, her melodious hope, a thing of special merit, a cleansing, the fleet leaf fall of something godly blowing through the world. Two of the charismatics come in to watch TV. These are people from the top floor, operating the only church in the wall, a congregation of Pentecostals seeking to receive the gift of the Spirit. Laying on hands, shouting out words, prophesying, the whole rocking, socking package that makes Edgar want to run and hide. Of course, they look at her a little sideways, too. Ismael appoints four members of the crew to go with the nuns and distribute food in the area. But the crew is rooted right now. They urge Juano to pedal faster because this is the only way to change channels, and they want to watch cartoons or movies, something with visuals, better than the head. They're saying, "Go, man, faster, faster!" The bicycle boy bends and pumps, and the picture wavers briefly, but then springs back to the round announcer's face and the moving lines of prices. Ismael stands there laughing. He loves the language of buying and selling, and the sight of those clustered sets of letters that represent enormous corporate entities with their jets and stretches and tanker fleets. He starts pulling kids off the cushionless sofa and stone-slinging them toward the door, while the other kids and the jivey charismatics keep urging Juano on. They're saying, "Faster, faster, you the man!" The boy cranks and strains, bouncing on the seat, but the numbers keep flowing across the screen. Electronics slightly up, transports down, industrials more or less unchanged. Three weeks later, Edgar sits in the van and watches her partner emerge from the red brick convent. Rolling gait, short legs, and squarish body. Gracie's face is averted as she edges around the front of the vehicle and opens the door on the driver's side. She gets in and grips the wheel, looking straight ahead. "I got a call from the precinct near the wall." Then she reaches for the door and shuts it. She grips the wheel again. "Somebody raped Esmeralda and threw her off a roof." She starts the engine. "I'm sitting here thinking, who do I kill?" She looks at Edgar briefly, then puts the van in gear. "Because this is the only question I can ask myself without giving in to despair." They drive south through local streets, the tenement bricks smoked mellow in morning light. Did Edgar know this would happen? Lately, yes, a knowing in her bones. She feels the weather of Gracie's rage and pain. In recent days, she'd approached the girl, Gracie had, and talked to her from a distance, and thrown a bag of food and clothing into the pokeweed where Esmeralda stood. They ride all the way in silence, with the older nun mind-reciting questions and answers from the Baltimore Catechism. The strength of these exercises, which are a form of perdurable prayer, rests in the voices that accompany hers, children responding through the decades, syllable crisp, a panpipe reply that is the lucid music of her life. Question and answer. What deeper dialogue might right minds devise? She reaches her hand across to Gracie's on the wheel and keeps it there for a digital tick on the dashboard clock. "Who made us? God made us." Those clear-eyed faces so believing. "Who is God? God is the supreme being who made all things." She feels tired in her arms. Her arms are heavy and dead, and she gets all the way to lesson 12. When the projects appear at the rim of the sky, upper windows white with sun play against the broad, dark face of beaten stone. When Gracie finally speaks, she says, "It's still there." "What's still there?" "That knocking in the engine. Hear it? Hear it?" "I don't hear a thing." "Cuckoo, cuckoo." Then she drives the van down past the projects toward the painted wall. When they get there, the angel is already sprayed in place. A winged figure in a pink sweatshirt and pink and aqua pants, and a pair of white Nike Air Jordans with the logo prominent. She was a running girl, so they gave her running shoes. And little Juano still dangles from a rope. winched down from the roof by the old hand-powered hoist the crew uses to grapple cars onto the deck of their flatbed truck. Ismail and others bend over the ledge, attempting to shout correct spellings down to him as he drifts to and from the wall, leaning in to spray the interlaced letters that mark the great gone era of wild-style graffiti. The nuns stand outside the van watching the kid finish the last scanted word, and then see him yanked skyward in the cutting wind. Esmeralda Lopez, 12 year, protected in haven. When they get to the third floor, Ismail is smoking a cigar, arms folded on his chest. Gracie paces the room. She doesn't seem to know where to begin, how to address the nameless thing that someone has done to this child they'd so hoped to save. She paces. She clenches her fists. They hear the gassy moan of a city bus some blocks away. Ismail, you have to find out who this guy is that did this thing.
You think I'm running here? LAPD?
You have contacts in the neighborhood that no one else has.
What neighborhood? The neighborhood's over there. This here's the wall. It's all I can do to get these kids so they spell a word correct when they spray their paint. When I was writing, we did subway cars in the dark without a letter misspell.
Who cares about spelling? Gracie says. Edgar used to care, but not today, and maybe never again. She feels weak and lost. The great terror gone. The great throne shadow dismantled. The launched object in the sky named for a Greek goddess on a bell crater in 500 B.C. All terror is local now. Some noise on the pavement very near. The stammer of casual rounds from a passing car. Someone who carries off your child. Ancient fears revived. They will steal my child. They will come into my house when I'm asleep and cut out my heart because they have a dialogue with Satan. She says a desperate prayer. Pour forth, we beseech thee, O Lord, thy grace into our hearts. 10 years' indulgence, a blockbuster number, if the prayer is recited at dawn, noon, and eventide, or as soon thereafter as possible. One of the girls is pedaling the bike, Willie for short, and she calls out to them,
"Hey, here, look!"
And they gather at the TV set and stand astonished. There is a news report of the murder, their murder, and it is freaking network coverage, CNN. Tragic life and death of homeless child. The crew is stunned to see footage of the wall, 2.5 seconds of film that shows the building they're in, the facade of spray-painted angels, the overgrown lots with their bat caverns and owl roosts. They gawk and buzz, charged with a kind of second sight, the things they know so well seen inside out, made new and nationwide. They stand there smeared in other people's seeing. Then the anchorwoman comes on. They tell Willamette to pedal faster, man, because the picture's beginning to fade, and the anchorwoman's electric red hair is color running from her head in a luminous ring, which makes her all the more amazing. And she describes their lives to them in a bell-tone, virgin voice, a woman so striking of feature she makes the news her own. And Willie pedals for all she's worth, and they urge her firmly on. Sister doesn't watch. She sees nothing for the rest of that day and the day after, and the 2 or 3 weeks after that. She sees the human heart exposed like a pig's muscle on a slab. That's the only thing she sees. She believes she is falling into crisis, beginning to think it is possible that all creation is a spurt of blank matter that chances to make an emerald planet here, a dead star there, with random waste between. The serenity of immense design is missing from her life, authorship, and moral form. And when Gracie and the crew take food into the projects, Edgar waits in the van. She is the nun in the van. And when Gracie maces a rat at the curbstone, Edgar does not blink. It is not a question of disbelief. There is another kind of belief, a second force, insecure, untrusting, a faith that is spring-fed by the things we fear in the night. And she thinks she is succumbing. Keystroke 1. She sleeps on the roof when it is not too cold. And this is where he sees her, on the roof of a boarded four-story building with fire escape intact. He's up there, wandering, thinking his thoughts, a man who drifts in and out of the wall, a sidler type, doesn't like to be looked at. And when you enter a name search, the screen reads, searching. He comes across the sleeping girl and feels a familiar anger rising, and knows he will need to do something to make her pay. He's on her like that. She tries to fight but does not cry out. He beats her with the end of his fist, sending hammer blows to the head. Struggle, bitch, get hit. He wants to turn her over on her face and put it up inside her. She fights and whisper cries in a voice that makes him angrier, like who the fuck she thinks she is. And the screen reads, searching. Either way is going to hit her, she struggled or not. And he looks away when he does it, sidle type. No eye contact, cunt. Last woman he looked at was his mother. After he does it, driving it in and spilling it out, he hits her one last time, hard, whore, and drags her up on the ledge and leans her over and lets her go. You dead, bitch! Then he goes back to thinking his nighttime thoughts. Screen reads, searching. Then the stories begin. Word passing block to block, moving through churches and soupirettes, maybe garbled slightly, mistranslated here and there, but not deeply distorted. It is clear enough that people are talking about the same uncanny occurrence. And some of them go and look and tell others, stirring the hope that grows when things surpass their limits. They gather after dusk at a windy place between bridge approaches, 7 or 8 people drawn by the word of 1 or 2, then 30 people drawn by the 7, then a tight, silent crowd that grows bigger but no less respectful, 200 people, wedged onto a traffic island in the bottommost Bronx, where the expressway arches down from the terminal market and the train yards stretch toward the Narrows. All that old industrial muscle with its fretful desolation. The ramps that shoot tall weeds, and the waste burner coughing toxic fumes, and the old railroad bridge spanning the Harlem River, an open-work tower at either end, maybe swaying slightly in persistent wind. They come and park their cars, if they have cars, 6 or 7 to a car, parking tilted on a high shoulder, or in the factory side streets, and they wedge themselves onto the concrete island between the expressway and the pocked boulevard, feeling the wind come chilling in and gazing above the wash of standard rip-roar traffic to a billboard floating in the gloom. An advertising sign scaffolded high above the riverbank and meant to attract the doped-over glances of commuters on the trains that run incessantly down from the northern suburbs into the thick of Manhattan money and glut. Edgar sits across from Gracie in the refectory. She eats her food without tasting it, because she decided years ago that taste is not the point. The point is to clean the plate. Gracie says, "No, please, you can't." "Just to see." "No, no, no, no. I want to see for myself." "This is tabloid. This is the worst kind of tabloid superstition. It's horrible. A complete abdication, you know? Be sensible. Don't abdicate your good sense." It could be her they're seeing. "You know what this is? It's the nightly news. It's the local news at 11 with all the grotesque items neatly spaced to keep you watching the whole half hour." "I think I have to go," Edgar says. "This is something for poor people to confront and judge and understand, and we have to see it in that framework. The poor need visions, okay?" "I believe you are patronizing the people you love," Edgar says softly. "That's not fair." "You say the poor, but who else would saints appear to? Do saints and angels appear to bank presidents? Eat your carrots.
It's the nightly news. It's gross exploitation of a child's horrible murder.
But who is exploiting? No one's exploiting, Edgar says. People go there to weep, to believe.
It's how the news becomes so powerful. It doesn't need TV or newspapers. It exists in people's perceptions. It's something they invent, strong enough to seem real. It's the news without the media.
Edgar eats her bread. I'm older than the Pope. I never thought I would live long enough to be older than a Pope. And I think I need to see this thing.
Pictures lie, Gracie says.
I think I need to be there.
Don't pray to pictures. Pray to saints.
I think I need to go.
But you can't. It's crazy. Don't go, sister.
But Edgar goes. She puts on her latex gloves and winter cape and heads for the door, planning to take the bus and subway. And Gracie can't let her go alone. She rushes out to the van, wearing her retainer for spacey teeth, a thing she never wears in public. And they drive down past the wall and into dark and empty streets. And the van stalls out, doing a murmurous swoon. And they walk the last 11 blocks, with Gracie carrying mace and a cellular phone. A madder orange moon hangs over the city. People in the glare of passing cars, hundreds, clustered on the island, their own cars parked, cockeyed and bias-wise, dangerously near the speeding traffic. The nuns dash across the boulevard and squeeze onto the island, and people make room for them, pressed bodies part to let them stand at ease. They follow the crowd's stoked gaze. They stand and look. The billboard is unevenly lighted, dim in spots, several bulbs blown and unreplaced. But the central elements are clear, a vast cascade of orange juice pouring diagonally from top right into a goblet that is handheld at lower left, the perfectly formed hand of a female Caucasian of the middle suburbs. Distant willows and a vaguish lake view set the social locus. But it is the juice that commands the eye, thick and pulpy, with a ruddled flush that matches the madder moon. And the first detail drops, splashing at the bottom of the goblet with a scatter of spindrift, each fleck embellished with the finicky rigor of some precisionist painting. What a lavishment of effort and technique, no refinement spared, the equivalent, Edgar thinks, of medieval church architecture. And the 6-ounce cans of Minute Maid arrayed across the bottom of the board, 100 identical cans, so familiar in design and color and typeface that they have personality, the convivial cuteness of little orange and black people. Edgar doesn't know how long they're supposed to wait, or exactly what is supposed to happen. Produce trucks pass in the rumbling dusk. She lets her eyes wander to the crowd. Working people, shopkeepers, maybe some drifters and squatters, but not many. And then she notices a group near the front, fitted snug to the proud shape of the island. They're the charismatics from the top floor of the tenement in the wall, dressed mainly in floppy white, tub-like women, reedy men in dreadlocks. The crowd is patient. She isn't, finding herself taut with misgiving, absorbing Gracie's take on the whole business. Planes drop out of the darkness toward the airport across the water, splitting the air with throttled booms. The nuns see Ismael Munoz standing 30 yards away, surrounded by his crew, Ismael looking a little ghostly in the beams of swinging light. And Edgar presses a knowing look on Gracie. They stand and watch the billboard. They stare stupidly at the juice. After 20 minutes there is a rustle, a sort of perceptual wind, and people look north. Children point north, and Edgar strains to catch what they're seeing. The train. She feels the words before she sees the object. She feels the words, although no one has spoken them. This is how a crowd brings things to single consciousness. Then she sees it, an ordinary commuter train, silver and blue, ungraffitied, moving smoothly toward the drawbridge. The headlights sweep the billboard, and she hears a sound from the crowd, a gasp that shoots into sobs and moans, and the cry of some unnameable, painful elation. A blurted sort of whoop, the holler of unstoppered belief. Because when the train lights hit the dimmest part of the billboard, a face appears above the misty lake, and it belongs to the murdered girl. A dozen women clutch their heads. They whoop and sob, a spirit, a god's breath passing through the crowd. Esmeralda! Esmeralda! Sister is in body shock. She has seen it, but so fleetingly, too fast to absorb. She wants the girl to reappear. Women holding babies up to the sign, to the flowing juice. Let it bathe them in baptismal balsam and oil. And Gracie talking into Edgar's face, into the jangle of voices and noise. Did it look like her? Yes. Are you sure? I think so, Edgar says.
But you've never seen her up close. I've seen her up close, Gracie says. And I think it was just a trick of light, not a person at all. Not a faith, but a stab of light.
When Gracie wears her retainer, she speaks with a kind of fizzy lisp.
It's just the undersheet, she says, a technical flaw that causes the image underneath, the image from the papered over it ad, to show through the current ad.
Is she right?
When sufficient light shines on the current ad, it causes the image beneath to show through, she says.
Sibilants echo wetly off Gracie's teeth. But is she right? Has the news shed its dependence on the agencies that report it? Is the news inventing itself on the eyeballs of walking, talking people? Edgar studies the billboard. What if there is no papered-over ad? Why should there be an ad under the orange juice ad? Surely they remove one ad before installing another. Gracie says,
What now?
They stand and wait. They wait only 8 or 9 minutes this time before another train approaches. Edgar moves. She tries to edge and gently elbow forward, and people make way. They see her, a nun in a veil and full habit and dark cape, followed by a sheepish helpmeet in a rummage coat and headscarf, holding aloft a portable phone. They see her and embrace her, and she lets them. Her presence is a verifying force, a figure from a universal church with sacraments and secret bank accounts and a fabulous art collection. All this, and she elects to follow a course of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They embrace her, and let her pass, and she is among the charismatic band, the gospelers rocking in place, when the train lamps swing their beams onto the billboard. She sees Esmeralda's face take shape under the rainbow of bounteous juice and above the little suburban lake, and there is a sense of someone living in the image, an animating spirit, less than a tender second of life, less than half a second, and the spot is dark again. She feels something break upon her, an angelus of clearest joy. She embraces Sister Grace. She yanks off her gloves and shakes hands, pumps hands with the great-bodied women who roll their eyes to heaven. The women do great two-handed pump shakes, fabricated words jumping out of their mouths, trance utterance, their singing of things outside the known deliriums. Edgar thumps a man's chest with her fists. She finds Ismail and embraces him. She looks into his face and breathes the air he breathes and enfolds him in her laundered cloth. Everything feels near at hand, breaking upon her, sadness and loss and glory and an old mother's bleak pity and a force at some deep level of lament that makes her feel inseparable from the shakers and mourners, the awestruck who stand in tidal traffic. She is nameless for a moment, lost to the details of personal history, disembodied fact in liquid form, pouring into the crowd. Gracie says,
I don't know.
Of course you know. You know, you saw her.
I don't know, it was a shadow.
Esmeralda on the lake.
I don't know what I saw.
You know. Of course you know. You saw her.
They wait for two more trains. Landing lights appear in the sky, and the planes keep dropping toward the runway across the water. Another flight every minute and a half. The backwashed roars overlapping, so everything is seamless noise, and the air has a stink of smoky fuel. They wait for one more train. How do things end, finally, things such as this? Peter out to some forgotten core of weary faithful huddled in the rain. The next night, 1,000 people filled the area. They parked their cars on the boulevard and try to butt and pry their way onto the traffic island. But most of them have to stand in the slow lane of the expressway, skittish and watchful. A woman is struck by a motorcycle, sent swirling into the asphalt. A boy is dragged 100 yards, it is always 100 yards, by a car that keeps on going. Vendors move along the lines of stalled traffic, selling flowers, soft drinks, and live kittens. They sell laminated images of Esmeralda printed on prayer cards. They sell pinwheels that never stop spinning. The night after that, the mother shows up, Esmeralda's lost, junky mother, and she collapses with flung arms when the girl's face appears on the billboard. They take her away in an ambulance that is followed by a number of TV trucks. Two men fight with tire irons, blocking traffic on a ramp. Helicopter cameras record the scene, and the police trail orange caution tape through the area. The very orange of the living juice. The next evening, the sign is blank. What a hole it makes in space. People come and don't know what to say or think, where to look or what to believe. The sign is a white sheet with two lonely words, space available, followed by a phone number in tasteful type. When the first train comes at dusk, the lights show nothing. And what do you remember, finally, when everyone has gone home and the streets are empty of devotion and hope, swept by river wind? Is the memory thin and bitter, and does it shame you with its fundamental untruth, all nuance and wishful silhouette? Or does the power of transcendence linger, the sense of an event that violates natural forces, something holy that throbs on the hot horizon? The vision you crave because you need a sign to stand against your doubt. Edgar feels the pain in her joints, the old body deep in routine pain, pain in the points of articulation, prods of sharp sensation in the links between bones. But she holds the image tight in her mind, the fleeting face on the lighted board, her virgin twin who is also her daughter. And she recalls the smell of jet fuel. This is the incense of her experience, the burnt cedar and gum, a retaining medium that keeps the moment whole, all the moments, the swaying soul-clap raptures, and the unspoken closeness, a fellowship of deep belief. There is nothing left to do but die. And this is precisely what she does. Sister Alma Edgar, Bride of Christ, passing peacefully in her sleep, the first faint snow of another dim winter falling slowly on the unknown streets, flurries, crystals, shaped flakes, a pale slant snow disappearing as it falls. Keystroke 2. In her veil and habit, she was basically a face, or a face and scrubbed hands. Here, in cyberspace, she has shed all that steam iron fabric. She is not naked exactly, but she is open, exposed to every connection you can make on the World Wide Web. There is no space or time out here, or in here, or wherever she is. There are only connections. Everything is connected. All human knowledge gathered and linked, hyperlinked. This site leading to that, this fact referenced to that. A keystroke, a mouse click, a password, world without end, amen.
But she is in cyberspace, not heaven, and she feels the grip of systems. This is why she's so uneasy. There is a presence here, a thing implied, something vast and bright. She senses the paranoia of the web, the net. There's the perennial threat of virus, of course. Sister knows all about contaminations and the protective measures they require. This is different. It's a glow, a lustrous, rushing force that seems to flow from a billion distant net nodes. When you decide on a whim to visit the H-bomb homepage, she begins to understand. Everything in your computer, the plastic, silicon, and mylar, every logical operation and processing function, the memory, the hardware, the software, the ones and zeros, the triads inside the pixels that form the on-screen image, it all culminates here. First, a dawn light. A great aurora glory massing on the color monitor. Every thermonuclear bomb ever tested. All the data gathered from each shot. Code name, yield, test site, Eniwetok, Lop-Nor, Novaya Zemlya. The foreignness, the otherness of remote populations implied in the place names. Mororoa, Kazakhstan, Siberia. And the wreath work of extraordinary detail. Firing systems and delivery systems. Equations and graphs and schematic cross-sections. Shot after shot summoned at a click, a hit. Bravo, Romeo, Greenhouse Dog. And Sister is basically in it. She sees the flash, the thermal pulse. She hears the rumble building, the great gathering force rolling off the 16-bit soundboard. She stands in the flash and feels the power. She sees the spray plume. She sees the fireball climbing, the superheated sphere of burning gas that can blind a person with its beauty, its dripping Christ-blood colors, solar golds and reds. She sees the shockwave and hears the high winds and feels the power of false faith, the faith of paranoia. And then the mushroom cloud spreads around her, the pulverized mass of radioactive debris 8 miles high, 10 miles, 20, with skirted stem and smoking platinum cap. The jewels roll out of her eyes, and she sees God. No, wait, sorry. It is a Soviet bomb, she sees, the largest yield in history. A device exploded above the Arctic Ocean in 1961, preserved in the computer that helped to build it, 58 megatons. Add the digits, and you get 13. Whole populations potentially skelly-boned in the massive flash. Dem bones, sing the washtub women. And Sister begins to sense the by-shadows that stretch from the awe of a central event. How the intersecting systems help pull us apart, leaving us vague, drained, docile, soft in our inner discourse, willing to be shaped, to be overwhelmed. Easy retreats, half-beliefs. Shot after shot, bomb after bomb, and they are fusion bombs, remember. Atoms forcibly combined, and even as they detonate across the screen, again and again, there is another fusion taking place. No physical contact, please, but a coupling all the same. A click, a hit, and Sister joins the other Edgar, a fellow celibate and more or less kindred spirit, but her biological opposite, her male half, dead these many years. Has he been waiting for this to happen? The bulldog-fed J. Edgar Hoover, the law's debased saint, hyperlinked at last to Sister Edgar. A single fluctuating impulse now, a piece of coded information. Everything is connected in the end. Sister and brother. A fantasy in cyberspace, and a way of seeing the other side and a settling of differences that have less to do with gender than with difference itself. All argument, all conflict, programmed out. Is cyberspace a thing within the world, or is it the other way around? Which contains the other, and how can you tell for sure? A word appears. in the lunar milk of the data stream. You see it on your monitor, replacing the tower shots and airbursts, the detonations of high-yield devices set on barges or dangled from balloons, replacing the comprehensive text displays that accompany the bombs. A single seraphic word. You can examine the word with a click, tracing its origins, development, earliest known use, its passage between languages. And you can summon the word in Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, and Arabic, in 1,000 languages and dialects, living and dead, and locate literary citations, and follow the word through the tunneled underworld of its ancestral roots. Fasten, fit closely, bind together. And you can glance out the window for a moment, distracted by the sound of small kids playing a made-up game in a neighbor's yard. Some kind of kickball, maybe. And they speak in your voice. Or piggyback races on the weedy lawn, and it's your voice you hear, essentially, under the glimmer-glass sky. And you look at the things in the room, off-screen, unwebbed, the tissued grain of the desk wood, alive and light, the thick-lived tenor of things, the argument of things to be seen and eaten, the apple core going sepia in the lunch tray, and the dense measures of experience in a random glance, the monk's candle reflected in the slope of the phone, hours marked in Roman numerals, and the glaze of the wax, and the curl of the braided wick, and the chipped rim of the mug that holds your yellow pencils, skewed all crazy, and the plied lives of the simplest surface, the slabbed butter melting on the crumbled bun, and the yellow of the yellow of the pencils. And you try to imagine the word on the screen becoming a thing in the world, taking all its meanings, its sense of serenities, and contentments out into the street somehow. Its whisper of reconciliation. A word extending itself ever outward. The tone of agreement or treaty. The tone of repose. The sense of mollifying silence. The tone of hail and farewell. A word that carries the sunlit ardor of an object deep in drenching noon. The argument of binding touch. But it's only a sequence of pulses on a dullish screen, and all it can do is make you pensive. A word that spreads a longing through the raw sprawl of the city, and out across the dreaming bourns and orchards to the solitary hills. Peace.
The End. You've been listening to Underworld by Don DeLillo, narrated by Richard Poe. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Body Artist, also by Don DeLillo, narrated by Laurie Anderson. And Mrs. Ted Bliss by Stanley Elkin, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.